Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM. I'm Siegfried. And I've got some good news and bad news tonight. I'll start with the good news, and that concerns the recent BRICS summit, which just concluded in Johannesburg, South Africa, last Friday. Now, if you haven't been following international politics that much, you'd be forgiven for not knowing what the BRICS organization is. The name BRICS is an acronym for its member states, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And these five states, all fast-growing economies, mainly concentrated in the global south, originally came together in 2009 in a loose association based on economic cooperation, and have since moved to create a fully fledged alternative to Western-led international economic institutions like the IMF and World Bank. And this process of creating an alternative system, it was on the slow track for a long time, but has been accelerated to a remarkable degree after the US and European Union seized Russian assets and placed unprecedented sanctions on that country in response to the Ukraine war in 2022. That basically meant that we were in a crazy situation where one third of humanity was living under Western sanctions. You know, with their economies being squeezed, cut off from the US dollar, cut off from international financial payment systems like SWIFT, cut off from international credit, international loans, all that kind of stuff. And in this environment, even traditional US allies like Saudi Arabia came to realize that the US-led economic order is not safe. It's not safe for them. They could be the target of sanctions at any time. You know, the US could turn on them at any time and basically wreck their economy. You know, freeze their assets, cut them off from the dollar, cut them off from international trade, all this sort of stuff. And they came to realize that alternatives are needed. And this is what has led to, in the recent summit in South Africa, 6 new countries joining the BRICS organization. And these countries are Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. You know, incredibly diverse range of countries there. You know, very different from each other in many cases. I mean, some of those countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran were seen as irreconcilable enemies until very recently. And here they are in the same organization, you know, coming together, cooperating. And there are other countries set to join next year when Russia hosts the next BRICS summit in 2024. And what these very diverse countries, some of which are US allies like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, what they have in common is that they no longer wish to rely solely on the US dollar for international trade. They want to conduct trade in multiple currencies in order to secure their own financial and economic independence, so they won't have to worry about the US coming in, imposing sanctions, and destroying their economy because they don't like the actions of this or that government. You know, the kinds of sanctions which have been imposed on places like Iran or on Venezuela or on Cuba or Russia or a ton of other countries. Increasingly, like, you know, the US is putting pressure, economic pressure on China. You know, imposing restrictions, trade restrictions, embargoes, things like that, in order to slow down the Chinese economy. You know, very aggressive moves. And of course, all this pushes these different countries to push for alternatives. You know, it's in their interest to do so. They know that if they don't, they're vulnerable. And any one of them could be next on the US list. And if they're completely relying on the US dollar, if they're completely trading in US dollars, their economy could be kaput tomorrow. So this is really all about self-determination and the fact that so many countries are seeking to secure their independence by cooperating economically under a common international organization like the BRICS is a major step forward in undermining and counteracting the forces of imperialism and empire. Remember, imperialism and empire don't just manifest themselves in military terms. You know, in wars and conquests and things like that, and invasions. You know, they manifest themselves in sanctions, embargoes, trade manipulation, you know, different ways of putting pressure economically on different countries, cutting them off from international trade. All kinds of different coercive measures. So, in short, this is good news, very good news, you know, and the fact that these countries are doing this makes them a lot less vulnerable to economic exploitation and the kind of exploitation that came out of the economic order, which has existed since the end of the Cold War, where, you know, the U.S. and Fortune 500 companies can basically dictate terms to countries in the global south and basically say, yeah, we're going to basically, come in and take your resources, you know, your natural resources, exploit your labor, you know, very cheaply, and we basically almost give you nothing in return. We pay almost no taxes. We have the U.S. behind us. If you basically mess with our operations in any way or try to restrict us, we can impose all kinds of penalties on you. There's nothing you can do about it. We hold all the cards. And that's what's changing now. You know, as these countries increasingly come together and cooperate and basically create an alternative for themselves. There's a lot of uncertainty still in how that what that's going to look like. But the writing really is on the wall that American unipolar control of the world is really slipping away. And this is what independent journalist Max Blumenthal had to say about the BRICS summit in a recent interview that he did with The Hill. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Member countries of BRICS, a growing non-Western economic collective, are meeting for their 15th annual summit in South Africa this week with a big announcement. Five new member countries have been added to the current bloc: Egypt, Ethiopia, Argentina, the UAE, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. They join current members Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Now, at the summit, leaders from member countries discussed de-dollarization, Western global hegemony, and moving toward a multipolar world.
And a thinly veiled statement, Chinese President Xi Jinping wrote, quote, "One country obsessed with maintaining its hegemony has gone out of its way to cripple the emerging markets in developing countries. Whoever is developing fast becomes its target of containment. Whoever is catching up becomes its target of obstruction. But this is futile. As I have said more than once, that blowing out others' lamp will not bring light to oneself." Joining us now to weigh in is editor at The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, this feels like a really significant global shift, and an end, as people are saying, to Western hegemony that many people predicted as we headed into this Ukraine proxy war, China becoming more closely aligned with Russia, and this growth of this economic alliance that's meant to counterbalance Western hegemony and economic dominance seems to be really telling. Help us understand what's at stake here.
Well, this is the most historic gathering of the BRICS, which was founded in 2009 to democratize international trade and international institutions by fostering multipolarity, countering the bipolar, unipolar world that's emerged since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which has brought on disaster for the global South, as well as unchecked violations of international law through coalitions of the willing, as we've seen in Iraq and beyond. The BRICS aims to foster trade through a new development bank, as it's called, and this could potentially upend the hegemony, the domination of the dollar, particularly if states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which provide the basis for the petrodollar, which is itself the foundation of dollar hegemony, if they join and begin trading in local currency. For example, Saudi Arabia is discussing trading or selling oil to China in renminbi, which would break the dominance of the petrodollar. So the reason this gathering is so historic is because BRICS is actually talking about expanding and has pledged to expand to some very significant countries, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but of course, expansion can bring a lot of political complication.
The U.S. has been trying to, flex its influence all over the world for so long. You know, we spent so much money. We're spending so much money right now in Ukraine, the projects in the Middle East, the bases everywhere, on and on and on. Do you think the American people might feel at some point cheated by their government that so much money of this money has been spent? And you might say that was not a good idea to do this in the first place, but we did do it, and yet we did not. Our influence is in decline, despite how much effort and how many resources we've exhausted to remain, the top country, the top government in the world.
Well, our correspondent Anya Parampil is in Johannesburg covering the BRICS right now, and one thing she's noticed at a conference which mostly pertains to the nations of the global South, especially the non-aligned nations that didn't line up with the Soviet Union or the U.S. during the Cold War and which seek to fight for their independence, is the presence of many Americans as well as British reporters from places like The Economist. What are they doing there? Well, they sort of represent the interests of the G7, which is often posited as the, you know, the dominant sphere of economic sphere. And they're threatened by what's happening at BRICS because of the prospect of de-dollarization, which is the, and the dollar hegemony is the basis for U.S. financial sanctions, which are administered unilaterally, not through the UN, to destroy the economies and the people of countries from Syria to Venezuela to Cuba, to countries like Eritrea, which is kind of the Cuba of Africa and has resisted IMF loans, taken its own line. And what the U.S. has done by actually sanctioning one-third of the world's population, think about that, is created a backlash where these countries are now gathering together and figuring out how they can conduct trade and break away from the dollar. And you've heard that expressed in the President's Roundtable today that was held and convened by UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres from Venezuela, for example, or from Eritrea, about the unfairness of global relations with the dollar dominating all trade and their desire to break it. They're not hiding their agenda right now. However, there are other nations like Brazil, which have feared expansion of the BRICS because they don't want to come to loggerheads with the U.S. And Brazil has only agreed to allow Argentina in at this point. But the desire is there, the possibilities are there, and the U.S. is making it almost impossible for many of these countries to operate within the Bretton Woods system and not be financially immiserated.
So I think what's really important, if you want folks to really understand what's going on here, is to get at the root of what Xi Jinping was saying in the quote that we read at the top. This idea that this isn't conspiracy, this isn't just, you know, our quote-unquote enemy talking, but that it has been an explicit in harshly inflicted policy of the United States of America to maintain global dominance by actively suppressing other countries as they grow and develop, either through sanctions, right, as you pointed out, with one-third of the world's people being sanctioned, or through other kind of economic tools like the IMF. But I do think sometimes we skip over how exactly something like the IMF, which many people understand is just, you know, a good thing that gives money to governments so that they can grow, right, and aren't we just being charitable? I mean, how do all of those global organizations, those financial organizations, act as a tool of the government in this way? And therefore, you know, and how does that help us understand why this BRICS alliance and the growth of the BRICS alliance is so important to shaking off the shackles of U.S. control, economic control?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that's the point of the New Development Bank, is to give out loans that are favorable to countries who do not want to have to meet the political conditions that the United States and its transatlantic partners mete out and impose on them. So we can look at what's happening in Argentina right now. After years and years of austerity imposed by the IMF because their reserves are dried up and they're experiencing hyperinflation, the country's shifting right. And the front runner in their election is Javier Milei, who's a right-wing libertarian, which may actually complicate their BRICS membership as well as Latin American cooperation. Or we can think of this in light of the Hunter Biden scandal and what the IMF, how the U.S. uses the IMF even against supposed allies. Joe Biden, when his son was on the Burisma board, went to Kiev and threatened them with an IMF loan, showing how the U.S. can control the IMF, and said, you will not receive this loan unless you, quote, reform your judiciary, fire the prosecutor, and do everything that might have been needed to protect Burisma from prosecution. So it actually fostered more corruption in Ukraine. And then once they got the loan, they had to meet all these austerity conditions, which have doomed the Ukrainian population, particularly Ukrainian workers, sold off their land. And so BRICS is presenting an alternative, and it's also politically significant that Russia and China are able to break through the attempts to isolate them, or in Joe Biden's words, reduce the ruble to rubble. Vladimir Putin, in his address to BRICS, pledged to actually supplant Ukraine as a global grain supplier to Africa and promised tons and tons of free grain to Africa. Africa has experienced the brunt of the Ukraine proxy war and U.S. sanctions and complications of grain exports. And so this is massive for Africa. And then we can look at what's happening inside Africa in the Sahel region, where you have these popular coups overthrowing governments that had been tools of the West, particularly Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, particularly tools of France. And Niger is following on the foothills of this multipolar development by starting a new company to not just export tomatoes and then import tomato paste, but to actually produce tomato-based products and to industrialize their gold production, which right now consists of a lot of youth in informal artisanal mines holding out pans in water. This is a massive development that will have a ricochet effect throughout the African continent.
Mm. Yeah, that's such an important point. I just did a deep dive on Niger on my own podcast recently. I was really shocked by an expert who was explaining the extent to which all of those countries in the so-called post-colonial era were very much still subject to control of by France through their currency and have been victims of a highly extractive relationship with France throughout and have intentionally their infrastructure and their development thwarted, while China's approach has been to build stadiums and infrastructure, and that's part of why it's been so dominant. One last question that I had for you, though, is the American public since the end of the Cold War has been convinced that America's efforts to maintain global dominance are in the interest of the American people. There was the domino theory and the broad public investment and the idea that you had to beat the Soviets, got to beat them to the moon, you got to beat them around the world. It justified any number of wars, Vietnam, et cetera, stopping the expansion of communism. Is something changing now, or are we still in a situation where the idea of other global powers emerging, namely China, is being used by people to beat the drum of war? And if that's the case, you know, how should Americans think about the decline of American dominance globally? Are they wrong to think that it will negatively impact their standards of living? And why should they think differently about perhaps a kind of global solidarity?
Well, we're looking at the decline of American hegemony, but this doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. is experiencing an economic decline. Our economy is completely financialized and based on artificially backed currency, but the U.S. has the means to do what other countries are doing to fuel its own development if it actually sought to do it, if it wasn't selling off its industrial base at the whims of corporations. But that's just not the reality that we've been living in. And I just think most Americans now oppose aid to Ukraine. They don't accept this argument that sending aid there is actually beneficial to Americans in any way, because they experienced what Biden falsely called the Putin price hike, which was actually the NATO price hike. By electing to sanction Russia, the U.S. was no longer able to offset the oil that it refused to import from Iran and Venezuela and other oil producers because of political sanctions on those countries. So Americans need to understand how their government sanctions have a boomerang effect at home. They are not going to experience it as strongly as Europeans or Africans, for that matter, but they're beginning to get the picture, and we see it even playing out in the Republican debates. Vivek Ramaswamy, who's just basically a proxy for Trump on so many positions, he successfully exposed the gulf between the Republican corporate elite and the Republican base on Ukraine, which understands that this war, it doesn't benefit it, and used it to break through in the debate, while the rest of the candidates took the George W. Bush position, which has been discredited. There's no candidate putting forward that line within the Democratic Party, but it will be exposed further throughout this campaign that Americans understand they don't benefit from this so-called rules-based order in which the U.S. seeks to make the rules and everybody else has to follow its orders. Americans would like to have friendly trade relations, too, to benefit their economic future. Yeah.
My Ramaswamy's break with the rest of the candidates on the Ukraine issue is something I talked about on My Radar, which viewers should check out if they missed it. Thank you, Max, so much for joining us.
Thanks, and check out the Gray Zone for coverage from BRICS by Anya Parampil.
Absolutely. We'll be right back.
yesterday. Him talk, him want to travel for the world to teach the people him what the true word of God. Make people stop to lie, say not lies for the world. If people stop to lie, and come and go fool the world. If people stop to lie, if we stop to lie, if we stop to lie, if we stop to lie.
Listening to Back in the USSR. At the beginning of the program, I said that I also had some bad news in addition to the good news about the BRICS summit in South Africa and the advancement of self-determination among global South countries. The bad news is that the Ukraine war continues. and that the U.S. and its Western allies are likely to try to keep it going until after the U.S. presidential elections in November 2024 for political reasons. In June 2023, Ukraine launched what it called a counteroffensive against Russia, which has now burned on for nearly 3 months with almost nothing to show for it. The Western media is openly calling it a failure now, while outlining the tens of thousands of casualties that Ukraine has suffered for minimal territorial gains. Now, for a brief period in mid-August, the media actually entertained the resumption of peace talks as a way out of the war. But unfortunately, that seems to have ended. And the West is now pressing Ukraine to keep throwing itself at the Russians, even as Ukrainian manpower and ammunition reserves are dwindling. In other words, the imperial overlords in Washington want to fight this war to the last Ukrainian and don't really care about the Ukrainian people at all, which is something I've been saying from the beginning of this conflict. They basically set this conflict up, guaranteed that it would happen, you know, refused all Russian overtures, you know, all Russian attempts to mediate the situation ahead of time. And they pushed Ukraine into this situation where they are now dying in the tens of thousands. So while the cause of self-determination is advancing with the BRICS summit, the imperialists haven't given up either. And the main goal of the American establishment seems to be to keep this war going, to avoid a Afghanistan-style debacle, like what happened, I believe, in 2021 when the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan after like 20 years of brutal occupation. You know, leaving that country in shambles. And it was a major, like, political blow to the U.S., like, admitting defeat there. The U.S. doesn't want to have the same thing happen in Ukraine. Not before the U.S. election. They want to make sure Joe Biden gets reelected. They don't want to the establishment doesn't want to damage his chances in 2024. So they want to drag this out. This is clear. This is clear from like all indications, statements of like U.S. officials, statements in the media, all that stuff. It's clear like from the decisions they're making, from like their decision basically to abandon the idea of peace talks, all that. They basically want to keep this going, drag it out. Doesn't matter how many Ukrainians have to die in the process. If there's going to be a failure in Ukraine, make it so that it's after the election's over and done with. Which is incredibly callous, and that's the attitude of imperialism right there. It's like we can use an entire country as cannon fodder in order to advance our interests and our timetable and our own elections, for that matter, our own electoral agenda. How about that? So this is what Alex Cristoforo and Alexander Mercuris of the Duran had to say about this terrible situation. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
All right, Alexander, let's do an update as to what is happening in Ukraine. We have the Kupiansk direction. We have the South Zaporozhye Rabotino direction. We have Zelensky giving a press conference and admitting that the counteroffensive is difficult. That's his way of saying that it's failed. He says it's difficult, but they're making small progress. That's his way of saying that they have failed. He admitted that a big mobilization may take place, or at least he's getting pressured for some sort of big mobilization by the military. That's a pretty alarming statement. And I actually read an article in the Telegraph, of all places, which talked about how Ukraine is is running out of men. Actually, I think that was the title from the Telegraph article, which was just basically it's the numbers are showing that Ukraine is running out of men and won't make it in this conflict. So we're starting to see the European or the UK media now coming out with articles talking about the catastrophic situation in the big counteroffensive and in Ukraine in general. So where should we begin? On the front lines or with the media angle?
Yeah, I'll just start with the British media quickly, because, of course, that is important, because the British media has been the last place to admit that there are problems with the offensive. And you're absolutely right. The Daily Telegraph article by Robert Clark not only said that Ukraine is running out of men, but it also said that Russia has victory in its sights. In other words, that you know they are now close to the point where Ukraine is going to reach the point of no return, and that there is nothing that the West can do to reverse the situation. So that's a pretty stark admission coming out of the British media. And there's been a similar report on the BBC, which you covered, I think, in one of your broadcasts. So we've had lots of things. We're having things like that even in Britain. Let's just deal first, however, with the situation on the battlefronts. And there are two stories there. One is Kupiansk, where there's a successful Russian offensive. And what's now happening, and it's pretty clear, is that the Russians are rolling up all the various Ukrainian fortified positions around Kupiansk. They've apparently destroyed some of the bridges across the Oskol River into eastern Kupiansk. They seem to be preparing for a strike to capture eastern Kupiansk. And that would then be the springboard, presumably, for a further offensive deeper into Kharkiv region. That would reverse the outcome of last autumn's offensive, where Ukraine regained ground in Kharkiv region. The psychological and military effect of that simply cannot be overstated. Now, Zelensky, when he did that press conference, I'm pretty sure that what he was hoping to do was to announce the capture of this village of Rabotino in Zaporozhye. And the Ukrainians made a massive attempt over the last 3 days to capture Rabotino. This is a little village north of the big Russian fortified lines. The Ukrainians have been trying to capture it since the second week of June. We've now 2.5 months they've been trying to capture this little village. They haven't been able to. They made a big effort. At one point, apparently, yesterday in the morning, they were in control of around 70% of it. They raised their flag over the local government building in this village. The Russians then counterattacked. They pushed them back. Very last report I've seen is that the Ukrainians have been pushed out of Rabotino completely. But that, I should stress, is a fluid situation. It might not be the case. Today is Ukraine's Independence Day. It seems that Ukraine was trying to capture Rabotino to celebrate, you know, to have a victory, to celebrate they finally captured this village. It seems that the Russians have acted to prevent that. And it left Zelensky looking, I thought, rather deflated over the course of that news conference. So he's not really got his F-16s. They're not coming, you know, for months. Probably only a few next year, none before the summer. He's not got his Gripens. He's not got Rabotino either. And we've had admissions from the British that Ukraine is running out of men. And we've now had statements from Zelensky himself, which say in effect the same thing, that the Ukrainian military now are worried that they're running out of men. Their losses are so high that they want a general mobilization. And that's a pretty grim situation for Ukraine to be in. Now, there's been another development, and which is that we've had an article in the New York Times, which is all about a conference, a video conference, which brought together Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, He's still chairman. He's not going to be there for very much longer, but he's still there. There was Cavalli, who was the commander-in-chief of NATO, American general. He's the commander-in-chief of NATO in Europe. There was Radekin, who is actually an admiral. He was the British chief of staff. So the British were also involved. And there was Zaluzhny involved as well. And according to the New York Times, the Western leaders, Milley, Cavalli and Radekin, they all told Zaluzhny, stop your offensive in Bakhmut. Give up on Bakhmut. This is a distraction. You're not getting any kind of progress there at all. Pull back, go on the defensive in Bakhmut. Reassign all your remaining men from Bakhmut to Zaporozhye and launch your attack there. Throw everything you've got left, despite all the losses you've suffered, on one last big throw to break through to Melitopol with all the remaining men that you have, that you know you've had at Bakhmut. So basically, write off Bakhmut, perhaps also places like Chasiv Yar nearby. Focus instead on everything you can do to try to break this land bridge. Zaluzhny is said to have agreed, but of course the final decision is not his. Up to this point, we've had lots of reports that Zaluzhny himself has not been happy with the Bakhmut counterattack. But we can see that the pressure is now on, that they're now really putting all their chips on one number, hoping that the next spin of the dice will enable them to at least achieve something before Ukraine finally runs out of men, ammunition, and the rains close in.
Yeah, but my question with this Melitopol strategy, first of all, I find it very interesting that so many publications are now talking about Melitopol. This really wasn't talked about much a month ago, the city of Melitopol. And this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about a small village of, you know, 50 people. No. This is a small city,
yeah.
Melitopol. So my question is, why all of a sudden are we talking about Melitopol? Melitopol still doesn't get you to the Sea of Azov, which was the main objective. You have another city, I believe Tokmak, that you have to get through before you get to Melitopol. And if you're going to throw everything you have now in this direction, even if we give the Ukraine military the benefit of the doubt and we say they break through the security zone, they get to Tokmak, break through there, and they eventually get to Melitopol, what is the calculation from Milley and these collective West generals that they'll be able to take over Melitopol in a week? I mean, is that really realistic? I mean, we're about to head into winter in 2 months. This sounds so... I mean, I thought these guys were generals.
Yeah.
I thought these guys were military professionals. It sounds like they really don't care. That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like, you know, Milley's sitting there saying, you know, just Zelensky's illusion. Just how many men you have in Bakhmut? Whatever. Just throw them in the south and just buy us some time. I mean, that's the impression that I'm getting. Does it make sense? Even if they did make a breakthrough, how do you hold these areas when you've lost all your men?
Yes.
I mean, how does that work?
You're absolutely correct.
And I think
there's a lot of things to say about this. The first is this, and I think this is an important point. This is supposed to be a war in which the West is supporting Ukraine. They're not supporting Ukraine. They're trying to micromanage Ukraine's war. They are trying to make decisions.
Ukraine.
Exactly, but they are forcing Ukraine to adopt their strategy. Now, you know, it may be. I mean, I personally don't understand what Ukraine's been doing in Bakhmut myself. We've been talking about this for months. But, I mean, at least that was Ukraine's decision. Now we see that not only does all this Western military aid come with strings attached, but it gives the Western powers, the United States, Britain, think that it gives them the right to give orders to Ukraine. Now, we're not naive people. I mean, the last thing anybody would say about the two of us is that we're naive people. We've known this all along. But look how completely the mask has fallen now. Till a few months ago, it was Zelensky makes this decision, Zelensky makes this decision, Zelensky makes this decision. Zelensky was Napoleon, if you remember. Zelensky was Caesar. Zelensky was Churchill. And this article in the New York Times basically is telling us they're actually really puppets on an American string. It's the Americans who make these decisions. What is supposed to be a war to preserve Ukraine as an independent country, we see that it has no capacity to make independent decisions because it is the United States that makes those decisions for it. That's one thing. The second is the utter callousness of what is being asked of Ukraine, because, again, the New York Times accepts that this attack towards Melitopol will incur enormous losses for Ukraine. Just go ahead, carry out these losses, be less risk-averse, throw away thousands more lives in battle. The Ukrainians are being criticised, wrongly as it happens, for trying to conserve lives. They're not actually. I mean, you know, if you read Russian accounts, they think that the Ukrainians are being profligate with the lives of their men. If you read Ukrainian accounts, increasingly, they think the same. But as far as the West is concerned, as far as the United States is concerned, they're not being profligate enough. They should be sacrificing even more lives to achieve objectives decided for them by the Americans. The third is, it's absolutely clear that the Americans, the United States, all along has been obsessed with Crimea and the control of the Black Sea. Now, to my mind, this is what this whole, a large part of what this conflict in Ukraine has been about all the way back, going all the way back to 2004. They want to somehow reach, if they can't reach the Sea of Azov, at least to cut the land bridge by getting Melitopol, shelling Crimea as well. They want ultimately to get control of Crimea. It's a US objective, even more than it is a Ukrainian one. And the Ukrainians are being sacrificed so that the US can achieve it. The US is prepared to give up Ukrainian ground in the Donbass, in Bakhmut, in Kramatorsk, in Slavyansk, in all of these places, so that it can hope, perhaps, to gain access to the Black Sea. And that's a startling thing. And the last is exactly what you said, that these are not really generals. These are political officials. Milley, Radikin, Karoly, they must all know that what is being demanded of Ukraine is militarily impossible. They've only got a few weeks to do it. They're not going to be able to capture Melitopol, even Topmak. US intelligence has already said as much. And yet they're pushing Ukraine to do that because they're political masters in the White House, in the National Security Council, in the State Department, in the Pentagon as well, are telling them to do that as well. So these are not, properly speaking, generals. They are simply messenger boys acting for the neocons, civilians, all without exception, who are the people who are really in charge.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this obsession with Crimea actually does originate from the United States, or if this is the UK whispering in the US's ears about.
That's a very good question. That is a very good question.
You know, there's history and emotion wrapped up into all of this. I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Jeffrey Sachs, who we've done programs with, talks about the British waging the Second Crimean War. And this is what increasingly this is starting to look at. If so, I mean, and bear in mind, we have a British admiral participating in this video conference. I mean, what is he even doing there? I mean, but he was there. And, you know, this is an admiral, so he's interested in establishing a base, a British base in the Black Sea. I mean, it's astonishing stuff and utterly delusional stuff. But we can see that this is now apparently shaping US policy. The neocons seem to be fully in on all of this, and they're bullying Ukraine to pursue this, to pursue the strategy, even as they admit that it will throw away the lives of thousands upon thousands of Ukrainian men. I have to say, I find this absolutely chilling, that one country or group of countries, the United States and Britain, are prepared to tell another country, Ukraine, to disregard the lives of the men it's sacrificing.
Yeah. That's why Ukraine will not and can never win this war, because they're not fighting a war for Ukraine. They're fighting a war for their masters in the West.
Yes.
And they're the ones that are taking their best interest to heart. They're not taking the best interest of Ukraine to heart as they fight this war. They're thinking about what they want and their best interests and their profits and their gains. That's why this is not going to work out. It never will work out. Final question. Die Welt put an article out a couple of days ago talking about a 3 million man mobilization. Now you have the comment from Zelensky saying that he's being pressured by the military. The military has given him some sort of indication or green light to mobilize a large amount of men to continue the conflict. Is this possible? Does Ukraine collapse if it moves forward with some sort of mass mobilization? We're talking a huge mobilization of millions of people. This is not like, an overnight process. This is complicated stuff, which is going to shake Ukrainian society across the board. I mean, you know, this is a society, I believe, that has been deprived of real information as to what is happening on the ground in the conflict. A lot of people probably think they're winning this conflict in Ukraine. What happens if the Zelensky regime just says, you know, puts out an announcement and says we're mobilizing 3 million men? Or 1 million men, or 2 million men. That is a huge undertaking, and I imagine something like that is going to cause a lot of problems inside Ukraine, and it may even cause problems for the Zelensky government itself. I mean, what do you make of the mobilization angle of this?
I think it potentially could collapse Ukraine. I mean, if any of these numbers, million, 3 million, whatever it is, if anything like that happened, and the first thing it would do, and this is the first thing to say, is that it would be an admission that Ukraine is losing the war. Not just losing the war, but is about to be not just defeated, but potentially destroyed. Because why else would you launch a mobilization on that scale? Now, a Ukrainian public that has been fed for a year and a half with a narrative of victory is going to take that very badly. Now, we've already had articles in the Washington Post saying that morale in Ukraine is sagging, that people are beginning to despair as the news and the offensive has, the good news has not come. I think if they're suddenly told, you know, they're all going to have to enlist, I mean, it's going to be a disaster. I mean, it will make morale collapse. And the logistics of this are impossible. I mean, calling up 1 million men, 3 million men, there isn't the time to train them. There isn't the time to equip them. What do you equip them with anyway? I mean, the West is out of tanks to send to Ukraine. The F-16s, as we saw, aren't coming until next year, probably not before the summer of next year, and not in significant quantities. The artillery is running out of shells. The Russian army is getting stronger. There isn't the time to provide training. There isn't the time to provide organization. It will have a catastrophic impact on the Ukrainian economy if all these people are called up, whatever is left of the Ukrainian economy, which isn't very much. I mean, if all the men have been called up, who's going to, for example, grow the food in the Ukrainian fields? I mean, you know, that kind of thing. So Not to mention the effect it will have on, you know, the women in Ukraine who lose their husbands, the children who lose their fathers. The whole thing is just, it's borderline insane to do something like this, at least on the kind of scale that people are talking about. So, and the mobilization has already been unpopular in Ukraine. We're getting more and more reports about more and more people in Ukraine, named people who've been killed or wounded in the war. Over 60% of Ukrainians know at least one person who's been killed. Most of them know more than one. As I said, Ukrainian society will collapse if it's expected to go through something like this. And the organizational and logistical and training challenges are impossible. And if you got through the point where all of that happened and were able to send, you know, a million men into battle, you could only send them presumably with light weapons, old Kalashnikovs and that sort of thing, because the tanks and the artillery and the machines that they would need to fight against this increasingly powerful Russian army simply don't exist. It's a crazy idea, and to me it looks like mass murder. The only thing that might make some sense is that allegedly there's 200,000 men in the active service Ukrainian army. Probably that has suffered huge numbers of losses by now. The Russians say 45,000 in the last 2 months killed. So, you know, call up another 100,000 to make up the numbers. Perhaps Ukraine could carry that out. Perhaps the Ukrainian military could absorb it, but it would not change the realities on the battlefields.
What Ukraine needs to do to wrap up the video, they need to capitulate.
Yes.
They need to surrender.
Yes.
Like yesterday.
Yes. Yes. But of course, they're doing the opposite. They're passing a law which says that it's illegal to even suggest territorial concessions to Russia. They're boxing themselves in even further. They are, in effect, playing the game of fighting this war to the last Ukrainian. And when you read that article in the New York Times, it seems that the Western powers are almost ready to do that. And when you look at what the Ukrainian leadership is doing, it seems that they're almost ready to do that as well. This is turning into a tragedy on a biblical scale.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Please, they arrest me,
materialist detests me. Pollution that chokes me. Movies that joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me. Hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.